This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. For the week of June 17th, here are some top stories. In the news, here's KJZZ's Christina Estes and Steve Goldstein.
For the second straight night, Phoenix leaders got an earful from people calling for some police officers to be fired. And now some officers want to see a vote of no confidence against the police chief. Meanwhile, a new council member hopes to deliver on a campaign promise to increase police accountability. KJZZ's Christina Estes joins me now to talk about these latest developments following a viral video that's gained attention nationwide. And Christina, before we start, let's remind listeners what, in fact, that video shows.
It's a bystander's cell phone video, and it shows police cursing and pointing guns at a family with young children after responding to a shoplifting call.
Now, the police chief and the mayor both apologized for the officer's behavior, and an internal investigation is underway. And now there could be more action because of a new council member?
That's right. Council member Carlos Garcia was just sworn in a couple weeks ago. He campaigned on a promise to hold police accountable and increase transparency at City Hall. He showed up at yesterday's meeting wearing a shirt that read, "End police brutality." And he remained quiet as the council listened to hours of public comment. People asked the council to vote against a citywide budget, which included more than $700 million for the police department. Here's a sample of what was said.
Yesterday and today was about one thing, and that is about the criminalization of Black and brown people. When they see us, we need them to not see criminals, but to see citizens and residents of the Phoenix community.
And I'm also calling for possible early retirement of officers that serve over 15 to 20 years, as it may appear that deterioration of civility begins to occur within some of our officers during that period of time of service.
People do wrong, but even when they do wrong, they're people. Don't treat them like animals. They're human beings who sometimes pay the police officers' salaries.
These are painful stories to share. They drain us.
So you're wondering why there's so much chaos and so much anger. It's because nothing is being done.
About 15 minutes into public comment, after hearing officers labeled as murderers and terrorists, Councilman Sal DeCicio had had enough.
Councilman DeCicio. I've got to push back on some of these negative comments because the media's here. I want the media to know that not everybody in the city believes this crap, because that's what this is. It is all wrong. No, you're all wrong.
Please be respectful.
We can disagree. So this is what happens.
From that point on, there were occasional boos, personal attacks, and some foul language from the audience. After nearly 4 hours of comments, Councilmember Carlos Garcia asked for three things.
And what are those three?
He wants the council to create an ad hoc committee to make sure past community recommendations are implemented. About 4 years ago, there were 15 recommendations to improve police and community relations. And according to Councilwoman Laura Pastor, 12 have been implemented. And you may recall earlier this year, the department paid $150,000 for the National Police Foundation to look into last year's record number of officer-involved shootings. Its recommendations included a staffing study, more realistic training, and better data collection, among other things.
Well, you mentioned three, so what are the other requests by Councilmember Garcia?
He asked to move forward to create a civilian review board with the power to subpoena police officers.
Okay, what kind of reaction did that get?
Well, he got cheers from the audience because that's been a big push. They feel like regular citizens should have a deeper role when it comes to evaluating officer conduct. Mayor Kate Gallego committed to calling the council together to address both the civilian review board and the ad hoc committee.
And then what was Garcia's third ask?
He wanted to find a way the council could move toward firing the officers shown in the video. And that is a pretty big ask because of the legal process. It's not just about city ordinances, department policies, or employment contracts. Mayor Kate Gallego explained how state law impacts the city.
And the city attorney explained the Arizona legislature has given additional due process rights to police officers. This legislative session, they continued to expand that. So police officers have different due process rights than other city employees.
After that discussion, the council did approve the budget, and then you heard from the union representing police officers?
I did. Some officers have asked the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association, known as PLEA, to organize a vote of no confidence against Chief Williams. PLEA's President Britt London tells me they're listening to membership, but consider a vote to be an extremely serious matter. He says PLEA wants to focus on the situation at hand and wait for the completed investigation before having further dialogue with members about their concerns with the chief's public comments.
So how does PLEA feel about the council even considering creating a civilian review board and the ad hoc committee?
London told me the PLEA board needs to meet and talk about it before he will issue a statement.
Obviously, a lot more still to come on this. KJZZ's Christina Estes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, here's co-host Mark Brody.
Arizona utility regulators today are expected to consider a proposal that would prohibit utilities from shutting off customers' power during the summer. The discussion comes in the wake of the revelation in Phoenix New Times that a Sun City West woman died after her power was cut. She owed around $50 to APS. Authorities are calling the woman's death heat-related. With us now to talk about what this new proposed rule would do is Ryan Randazzo of the Arizona Republic. Hey, Ryan.
Morning.
So what specifically would it do? We mentioned that it would basically say utilities cannot cut off power in the summer, but what are some of the more specific details of it?
Well, the regulators could also issue an order that says, you know, the weather's too dangerous to shut off power at any time of the year. And so it would codify that. And really, it just brings more attention to the authority that the commissioners have to do something about this issue and set regulations and parameters on when utilities can turn people's power off.
Does it seem as though a majority of commissioners are on board with this?
Yeah, this is absolutely going to pass. The commission actually directed utilities yesterday to begin preparing their filings for how they're going to comply with this order. And that's pretty unusual, I have to say. One, it's unusual to have an emergency rulemaking where the commissioners act this swiftly on any issue. And then to tell utilities, basically, get ready for this rule that we haven't passed yet, but that we're pretty darn sure we're going to pass. So, I don't think there's going to be a lot of debate on whether or not to make this change, but there could be some amendments on how it's implemented. There was actually one suggestion from a commissioner yesterday that anyone who had already been cut off from power this month would be restored and they would not pay the reconnection fee or any other fees that APS might charge them for that.
And is the plan that, assuming it does pass, that it would take effect immediately?
That it would, yeah, it would take effect tomorrow. And then the commission would commence a regular rulemaking to not only pass this this change, but anything else that they want to implement regarding shutoffs, but that might require a little bit more discussion or research on their part.
Ryan, Governor Ducey hasn't been shy about criticizing this, even using the phrase mission creep, and happened to see Commissioner Burns on PBS last night. And he basically said that the governor needs to read the Constitution. Is this going to cause any rift? And I mean, not from the political standpoint, but actually in terms of the way the commissioners can get things done.
Yeah, the mission creep statement from the governor was bizarre. I mean, you have someone who died because a utility cut off their power. And that talking point from Ducey, it really reflects a long simmering debate between the commission and other elected officials in Arizona regarding how much authority the commission actually has. And it doesn't just pertain to whether or not they can tell utilities when they can't shut people off from their power, but also can the commission set renewable energy policy and do other things that aren't directly related to rate making. This, you know, was very strange to hear the governor say that, but that comment from him, the mission creep, is something that I've heard in different contexts over the years, you know, regarding how much authority should the commission have regarding statewide policy and how much should the state legislature have when it comes to setting renewable energy policies in the state. So, but this is such a clear-cut issue for the five commissioners. I don't see a big debate on whether or not they actually pass this today. It's more of what minor changes might they make around the edges.
Ryan, quickly before we let you go, are the utilities okay, the utilities that would have to implement this? Do they seem okay with the proposed rule?
Well, APS issued a pretty bland statement just saying that they agree with the proposal. I don't predict that they're going to argue about this very much either, considering the position they're in, you know, where they shut off power to a woman on a hot day and that woman died. I don't know how they could stand up and argue, against this policy right now. We did see a little bit of blowback from the staff at the commission saying that this is going to raise utility rates for other customers because other customers pay the utility's expenses. So if the utility has more bad debt expense, then that goes to everyone else who pays their bills. I'll be interested to see how much debate that actually gets today, considering considering the atmosphere here and what actually happened to this woman. It'll be interesting to see if the commission really pushes that that argument that this is unfair to other customers.
All right. That is Ryan Randazzo with the Arizona Republic. Ryan, thank you.
Yep. Have a good day.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. In Fronteras news, Governors Doug Ducey and Claudia Pavlovich traded friendly compliments at the last meeting of the Arizona-Mexico Commission, but they've since had to confront a host of national political issues. Recently, the leaders took different positions on President Donald Trump's threat to impose tariffs on Mexico. But just this week, they sent joint letters reaffirming the bonds between Arizona and Sonora and urging both countries to ratify the renegotiated NAFTA deal. And now both governors meet next week to tout the relationship between the two states. We start our report with the Fronteras Desk's Murphy Woodhouse in the Hermosillo Bureau.
Buenos dias. Gracias. It is wonderful to be back in Sonora with my good friend and partner, Governor Pavlovich.
Back in late November, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey and his counterpart, Sonoran Governor Claudia Pavlovich, sat side by side during the annual Arizona-Mexico Commission meeting in Hermosillo.
Welcome again, Governor Ducey, my good friend.
They touted the strength of the trade relationship between the states, with a special focus on agriculture.
We are on the forefront of food safety and security in North America, with billions of pounds of produce crossing our border each year.
But a lot has happened since that meeting. President Donald Trump has threatened to shut down the border on several occasions and declared a national emergency to get additional border wall funding. All of that sent shockwaves through the border region, where many businesses depend on cross-border commerce. In late May, Trump threatened to impose steadily increasing tariffs on Mexican imports if the country didn't do more to curb U.S.-bound Central American migrants. In response, Ducey tweeted that, while he opposes tariffs, he prioritizes, quote, national security and a solution to our humanitarian crisis at the border above commerce. Pavlovich released a video stating her backing of Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's efforts to avoid the tariffs. She said national interests like jobs and investments were at risk. Neither governor did an interview for this story.
The last time they were hurt in this fashion, at least Sonorans, insulted by an Arizona governor, was Governor Brewer.
Marco Lopez, who was appointed executive director of the Arizona-Mexico Commission by Democratic Governor Janet Napolitano in 2004, says Ducey's initial response to the tariff threat came as a shock to some.
This governor had done a great job of erasing and healing those wounds to then just literally peel the scab in a matter of seconds.
But Gerardo Vasquez, who represents export manufacturers in Sonora, was not troubled by Ducey's response.
Creo que es atinado lo que dice el gobernador Ducey.
He thinks Ducey is right that security is a priority and that Mexico does need to do more to control the migrants crossing its territory. His response may have added a little stress, but Vasquez saw it as a political statement, not as a signal of dramatic change. There can be disagreements, but in no way do they destroy a long-standing relationship that is in everyone's interest, he says. Here's Matthew Casey in Arizona.
Just across the line in southern Arizona, the goal has always been to not let big-picture politics affect the relationship with Mexico, says Guillermo Valencia, chairman of the Nogales Port Authority.
I think that the relationship continues to be strong.
The Port Authority is a sponsor of the upcoming Arizona-Mexico Commission Summit, and Valencia says the goodwill that Ducey and Pavlovich have built is stronger than recent rhetoric. Polarizing politics could reach a point where they affect the governor's bond, Valencia says. Still, he doesn't think that's even close to happening. But if things continue?
I think that's always something to think about. It concerns us. But I think that's more of kind of like a footnote.
Ducey and Pavlovich share two traits, says Glenn Hammer, head of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
They're both very detail and results oriented.
Hammer points to progress on issues like tourism, transportation, mining, and water as evidence the Arizona-Mexico Commission is at its highest point ever. There's nothing wrong with governors having different views, he says.
You know, it's easy to get lost in Twitterville and tweets and statements. I would focus on what actually gets done.
The next chance for Ducey and Pavlovich to work together comes next week at the Arizona-Mexico Commission's 60th anniversary summit. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In business news, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody.
Why do we like the music we like, and how much say do we actually have on what we enjoy listening to? Nolan Gasser delves into those questions in his new book, Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. Gasser is a musician and composer. He's also the architect of Pandora's Music Genome Project. And Nolan, how much of the music that we like do we actually consciously determine that we like, and how much of it is what we're predisposed to enjoy?
So, you know, starting, you know, at the highest level, there's a lot about our musical taste that is well beyond our own control. A lot of the ways that music is made, whether it's here in the States or elsewhere, comes really out of the physics of sound, the fact that we like octaves, the fact that we like consonants, like major thirds and major chords more than dissonance, the fact that we like rhythm that's sort of steady and easy to follow, but yet spiced with some syncopation. These are sort of bred into us really cognitively through our own evolution and, again, through the actual physics of sound. And then as we dive deeper, a lot of our own individual musical taste is indeed seeded not by our own psychology or even our own personality, but by the sort of the culture that we grow up in, the types of sort of subcultures, the actual geography that we grow up in, the circle of friends that we hang out with, and especially in our youth. It's really only kind of in that last mile, as I call it, of our experience with music that it really becomes our individual taste as opposed to our spouse or our best friend or our siblings.
Well, it sounds like then if you are a fan of a band that maybe you or others find embarrassing, it might not be your fault.
I think there's a lot of things about our musical taste that we might not admit so readily, and I've got a few sort of funny anecdotes about that in the book. And part of that really comes out of the boundaries that we put in our own minds, and it's one of the sort of the themes that I try to run through the book. You know, music is so varied, and there's so much wonderful music out there that has our name on it. And a lot of it, you know, we kind of sort of attach certain meaning and certain identity to certain artists or genres, you know, that we could never possibly like Celine Dion or hip-hop or whatever it might be or classical music because it's not our thing. And so we really all owe it to ourselves to try to sort of check those biases at the door because almost every genre and style and approach of music has something that we ourselves can resonate with.
Well, I was wondering if there are certain of those criteria that are maybe more dominant than others. You know, you talked about culture and your upbringing and your geography. Do any of those matter more in terms of not so much what we're exposed to, but what we end up liking?
If I had to pick one of those interludes, if you will, I probably, at least at this moment, would say it's that subcultural level. I actually call it intraculture, those cultures within our culture. And we all navigate in and out of many, many of them based on, you know, our geography, our faith, our education, our income, our affinities. And all of those groups that we interact with not only help us to shape our own identity, but give us access to those cultural elements that are part of that intraculture, and that includes music.
Do you find that age does play a factor? I'm wondering if, like so many things, you know, there's like a comfort food, maybe there's like a comfort music, the types of songs that maybe you listen to at home or that your friends listen to when you were in grade school or high school?
You know, certainly, you know, we tend to think about our musical taste as being most sort of formed when we're young, you know, when we're in our teens and our 20s. And it's like after that, we no longer have the ability to find new music that we love. And I certainly want to kind of dispel that. I think music discovery is something that can last as long as we do. And especially now, you know, 2019, we have at our fingertips access to pretty much any style of music from any part of the world, from any century, like never before.
So you referenced how exposing people to different types of music is easier now, pretty much, than it has been at any point in history. I'm wondering about when people do that,
How much of whether or not they like something, is it a matter of keeping an open mind? Is it you just have to listen to it and, you know, kind of like to the earlier question, you're kind of predisposed to liking it, even if it's vastly different than what you're used to hearing and what you know you already like?
Well, you know, what your question is getting at kind of brings to my mind that there's a really fun quote. It's actually from the 1440s, so not one that many people know. It's from a theorist named, his name is Tinctoris, and he wrote that nothing that was written more than 40 years ago is worth listening to. You know, if you go through music history up until really into the 20th century or certainly into the 19th century, perhaps, people didn't really listen to music that was written more than 40 years ago. It's fascinating. But, of course, we have the ability, as never before, just with our overall orientation and now with technology, that we can go not just 40 years back, but 400 years back and far beyond that even. So, I mean, the process of understanding what's going on in that music and how it can relate to us, you know, takes some effort because we actually, our brain does gravitate and does sort of formulate its understanding of music based on the music of your own culture. And just as we, you know, if we try to speak a language when we start in our 20s, we'll speak with an accent. If we try to listen to music from another culture in our 20s for the first time, we will hear it with an accent. But it doesn't mean, unlike language, where we'd have a hard time understanding somebody, we can understand the music. We can get something out of it. I guess all that's to say that depending on the music that you're familiar with, you know, a certain kind of music will be perhaps alien and will take some effort, but it's certainly a journey worth taking. You may not love everything that you're hearing, but you're going to discover a lot more than you know now if you make it an actual effort.
All right. That's Nolan Gasser, author of Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. Nolan, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Education Desk. Osteopathic medicine students in Arizona are using new technology to better understand what it feels like to live in an aging body. From KJZZ's East Valley Bureau, Mariana Dale reports.
At A.T. Still University, I slip on gray fabric gloves. Wires send small electric impulses to my wrists.
Oh, my God. Okay.
My hands start twitching uncontrollably as if I had Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, that is so unsettling.
The gloves are one component of a GERT suit. It's short for gerontology, the study of aging.
When worn, it mimics a part of the body that gives them a sense of what it feels like to have a disability.
Laurie Ratto is an associate professor at the Mesa University. She explains how different parts of the suit make your joints stiff, muffle your hearing, and impair your eyesight. The goal for students here is to learn how to empathize with patients' challenges.
I think today's patients want a connection with their doctors. And in this kind of technology world where doctors hide behind computers, they've lost that connection with their doctors.
Ratto says the aging simulation suits were developed in Germany but are becoming more popular in U.S. medical schools as students prepare to treat increasingly older patients. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Mesa.
And finally, from the Science Desk, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody.
New research finds people with a higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease may start showing changes in their memory up to 40 years beforehand. The study of almost 60,000 people found those with a family history of Alzheimer's do not perform as well as those without that family history on a memory test. Family history has been associated with the risk of developing the disease. With me to talk more about the results is Dr. Matt Huntelman, professor of neurogenomics at TGen and senior author of the report. And Matt, it seems as though it's a pretty significant finding that someone who could be at higher risk for developing Alzheimer's disease might be showing some kinds of symptoms many years earlier.
Yes, I think it's important, though, to mention that these aren't necessarily symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, but rather what we saw is that people who have a family history of Alzheimer's disease might have lower memory performance even as early as in their 20s when we compare them to their peers who don't have a family history of Alzheimer's disease.
So that really seems to suggest that if you do have a family history of Alzheimer's disease,
that could really affect your memory from a pretty young age.
Yes, that's true. And I think that it's interesting to us because it's not something that these individuals might notice. So this doesn't rise to the level of impairing your daily performance or really impacting your daily life. However, if you really test these two groups of people, you can see that the ones who have a family history of Alzheimer's disease perform a little bit worse on the memory test.
What kinds of tests are we talking about here? Like, what specifically were you looking at?
In this particular study, we were looking at a specific type of memory called verbal memory. We were asking individuals to form new connections between two word pairs, and then you had to recall the word pairs when prompted.
Now, I imagine that you would be cautious to say that just having signs of maybe a weakened memory or not a great memory early on does not necessarily mean that you will absolutely develop Alzheimer's disease later on, right?
Yes, I think that's really important for people to realize that we all have good days and bad days with regards to our memory. And certainly the effects that we're finding in our study are really nothing to be concerned with. It's just interesting that there is a difference. So definitely this does not rise to the level of what you would call a clinical memory disorder. It doesn't rise to the level of dementia. But there is a difference. And that really is the thing that is brand new with our work.
So do you anticipate that this kind of data could impact, I don't want to call them treatments, but maybe things people can do earlier on in life if they have a family history of Alzheimer's disease and maybe they recognize that, you know, their memory maybe isn't as great as they wish it was?
Well, I hope that our report really helps people understand that lifelong health is really needs to be a lifelong focus. So many of the diseases that we are really worried about that are age-related, like Alzheimer's disease, for example, the path to avoiding those starts early in life. So adopting a healthy living lifestyle, eating well, exercising, those are some things which have shown to help decrease your risk for dementia. And I hope that some of this new work just emphasizes to people that those need to start early. We can't start them late in life as the risk increases, but the earlier you start those, the better off the outcome could be.
Do these data, in your mind, strengthen the connection between family history of Alzheimer's and somebody else in that family developing it?
I don't know how much they would strengthen it because it was already known that a family history of Alzheimer's disease does increase your risk for Alzheimer's. I think that these new findings surprised us because they extended how early we might see changes. And, you know, again, these are not changes that would lead to a clinical diagnosis, but they are changes that you can find when you compare groups that are very similar, with the big difference being one has a family history and one does not.
So what kind of research do you think has to come next to sort of take what you found and then have that work toward, you know, some kind of treatment or early diagnostic tool or something else that, you know, that would help folks either who are more at risk for developing Alzheimer's disease or maybe even folks who have already developed it?
Well, certainly one of the new areas that we are focusing on is this area that we call precision aging. It's very similar to what's happening right now in cancer with precision medicine, where patients are getting prescribed drugs specifically to target their cancer based on the composition of that cancer, the genetics, and other aspects of that cancer. We think there's a significant future in precision aging by targeting those aspects of aging that are most relevant to the individual. So what that means is we might suggest that a certain approach is important for someone with family history of Alzheimer's disease, and then for their friend who is just like them but has no family history, we might want to focus on different aspects of medicine for that person to help them age as best as possible with respect to their brain.
All right. That's Dr. Matt Huntelman, a professor of neurogenomics at TGen. Dr. Huntelman, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back.
And you're listening to KJZZ's Stories You Don't Want to Miss, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.